Bienvenidos a todos. Muchas gracias por estar aquí. My name is Peter Florence, and you will understand me better if I now speak in English and I am translated by my colleagues in the booth. It's a great pleasure to be here, and I am deeply grateful to the organization Irish Literature Abroad for bringing my guest, Ronan Bennett, to Cartagena. He is a writer who writes principally in three media. He writes journalism in The Guardian and The Observer in Britain. He is one of our foremost screenwriters, whose credits include Antonia Bird's film Face, an extraordinary contribution to 10 Days to War, the British television series, and has written, I think, one of the finest thrillers I've ever seen, set in Northern Ireland, called Love Lies Bleeding. His most recent film, which I think we will get to talk about later on today, is a movie Michael Mann is directing called Public Enemies, about John Dillinger. At the same time, he has written, alongside those largely contemporary film fictions, he's written a number of novels set largely in historical times, whose very titles suggest some of the turbulence and conflict within them. He started with a book called The Second Prison, then Overthrown by Strangers, his masterpiece, I think, The Catastrophist, and Havoc in its Third Year. Most recently, he has published a novel set in the dog days of Tsarist Russia called Zugzwang. It had an interesting genesis, but in welcoming you, Ronan, can I ask you just to clarify for non-chess players in the audience what Zugzwang means?
Zugzwang is a chess term. It's a chess term. You get into a position... Is that it?
Yeah.
Is that better? I'm sorry. Zugzwang is it's a chess term. You get into a position and any move you make results in your in-loss. It results in the immediate collapse of your position.
And the last time I saw you, you were talking in Hay on Wye with the great grandmaster Boris Spassky. How much has chess been part of your life?
Well, it's an embarrassingly large part of my life, especially for somebody who doesn't really play at any kind of very advanced level. But I'm fascinated by chess. With all hobbies, with all fascinations, it's quite hard to explain that to, you know, the person who doesn't share that fascination. But I wanted to, in Zugzwang, I thought the metaphor of Zugzwang itself was something that I could use, not just for the dog days of Tsarist Russia, but for the present. Because I don't really consider myself a historical novelist, but it is true that my last three books have been set in the past, in the 17th century, in 1960 in the Congo, and in the early 20th century in Zugzwang. But even though they're set in the past, I always try to make them in some way relevant, to have some kind of resonance with the present. And it seems to me that that Zugzwang, the position that the Tsarist regime was in, and at the beginning of the 20th century, it was that no matter what it did, it was going to collapse. It was under such pressures, internal, external pressures, that it was going to collapse. Personally, I consider that the position the West finds itself now in relation to radical Islam, I find it in a similar position. I think the West is in Zugzwang. If it hands out, if it does what Obama says, that it tries to extend the hand of friendship, it will be taken as a sign of weakness. If it continues to bomb and destroy and to kill Muslims, it will be taken, people will react angrily to it. I don't think there's anything they can do right. So I wanted to discuss Tsarist Russia, anti-Semitism in Tsarist Russia, but I also wanted to discuss the present.
Anti-Semitism as an allegory for concern about Islam now.
Yes. One of the things that was said at the beginning of the 20th century in Russia was that anti-Semitism was widespread. It went wide and deep, and to the very top, to the Tsar himself. And the questions they asked of Jews and Judaism was, why are you against us? Why do you hate us? What is it about your religion that makes you against us? And those same questions are being asked in some quarters in the West. So I want about Islam, and I wanted to address that in my book.
Equally at the heart of this book, there is the familiar character for your readers of the good man caught emotionally, motivated emotionally and amorously within the tide of huge historical events, which brings to mind the Edmund Burke dictum that all it needs for evil to triumph is a good man to do nothing. Your character of Otto Spethmann, and this is a book, I hasten to add, that is translated now into Spanish, and Ronan will sign afterwards. Your character is a psychoanalyst and hangs out with chess players and musicians and is inevitably part of that minority. Why did you choose to tell this story from his perspective?
I think I try not to write the same book twice. You know, I've set books in Ireland. I've set a book in Latin America, another book in the Congo, a book in Russia, a book in 17th century England. So I do try not to write the same thing twice. But I know that there is a central character who recurs, as you say. And that central character is somebody who's usually apolitical, is concerned to live a relatively quiet life, and who usually thinks of himself as a reasonably good man, flawed for sure, but somebody who is, his impression of himself, his belief in himself is as a good man. And I confront him with usually a dramatic dilemma, and I ask him, what does the good man do in times of chaos, strife, polarization? What do you do? Do you take a side? Do you get involved? If you do, at what cost? So Spethmann, the psychoanalyst, wants nothing more than to bring up his daughter. He has fallen in love. He wants to pursue that affair. He's absorbed by his work, but crashing into that settled, ordinary life come characters who bring with them not just danger, but a challenge to him, a challenge to his sense of decency and goodness. And they say to him, you can't continue like this, you have to do something, you can't just stand by.
How immersed were you in the historical period before you started the project?
Well, I did a PhD in history. I love history. It's my big passion, I suppose. And for me, the temptation always is just to, the research part of it is the nice part. I mean, writing books is really hard. I find it really hard. And the easy part of it, the pleasant part of it, the not hard part of it, is the research. So I'll happily, sit in my armchair reading book after book to immerse myself in it. So it took a couple of years of reading.
Did you immerse yourself in literature as well as history?
Much less so. Much less so. I, because of the peculiar circumstances of my upbringing and the political atmosphere I grew up in Ireland in the 1970s, literature, in the particular world I found myself in, was seen as not important. And to some degree, I've inherited that. It's with me still. That the idea that the word, the written word, can make a contribution in a severe political crisis, I still struggle with that idea. That's important. And I struggle sometimes with the sense that what I've been doing over the last 15, 16 years as a writer has been a complete waste of time. And I don't mean that in any kind of false, modest way or anything. But I do struggle with the idea that words have any kind of impact or worth. I was more concerned when I was growing up, particularly with reading politics, economics, history, philosophy. Literature came later for me.
Is it not true, and I may be venturing way out of my own knowledge here, that throughout the political turbulence of the last, say, the last 50 years in Northern Ireland, among the most treasured voices have been those of the poets? And is it not the case that in the English-speaking world, Ireland's wisdom and humanity has been more kept by Brendan Kennelly and Seamus Heaney than by any political voices?
Well, of course, this is, you know, this is true, but it's also complicated. If you take, for example, let's take the peace process in Ireland in the, at the beginning of the, at the late, from the late 1980s to the, right into the 90s. You would have to say that the initiative for that, for ending a conflict, did not come from writers or academics or thinkers. It came from the participants. It came from the street. And in fact, who was it that said poetry changes nothing? Poetry makes nothing happen.
Do we have in this audience anyone who knows the answer to this
poetry
question?
Poetry makes nothing happen. Auden? I think it might have been Auden. And I think there is that. There is a tradition in writing, a strong one, that says that the artist's work is compromised by any kind of political engagement. I mean, we know this. It's a strong. There's a strong. A strong tradition.
Well, it plays differently in different cultures. I mean, it's high.
Well, I think in Western Europe, certainly in Britain. You'd be hard pushed to find. I mean, Seamus Heaney's most quoted poem, political poem, is when he was offered, when he said, "My passport's green." Ireland in the old days, before it joined the European Community, had a distinctive green coloured passport. And when he was, when Seamus Heaney, the Nobel Prize winning Irish writer, I think was being co opted by the British. He said, "I'm sorry, my passport's green." But he's a gentleman, Seamus. He put it very gently. It was a gentle rebuke. And that's the, you know, there's the, if you're looking for kind of engagement from writers in that conflict, you'd have to look quite far.
I do want to come back to your own view of what you're doing as a writer, but specifically in relationship to The Catastrophist, which I think is a wonderfully self-examining piece of work about what a writer could do. But just talk to me quickly about the way in which Sugsvang was written. Although it is a piece about the ultimately controlling, or not about, but plays with the idea of chess, which is a controlled game in which you know many moves ahead what you're going to do. It was published first as a serial in a newspaper.
Yes.
How much of it, did you write it week on week, or was it simply portioned up after you'd finished the book?
No. Fue una pesadilla. writing Zugzwang was a nightmare. I don't know what possessed me. I had two chapters, the first two chapters, and the adaptation of Dickens's Bleak House had just shown on television, and it inspired. I thought, well, this is something new to do. I like a challenge. I like to do something different. So I sent the first two chapters to the editor of the Observer, and rashly suggested, you know, that this could be a serial novel. They were relaunching the Observer at the time. And I sent it to him on a Friday, and by the Monday morning I'd decided that I wouldn't do it, that I'd write to him and say, "Look, sorry, it was a mistake." And I was cycling across the park with my kids to school, and my mobile went. I picked it up, it was him. He said, "Great, let's do it, we'll do it now." And I couldn't, and then he persuaded me, and he said, I made a lot of mistakes doing it as a serial. I mean, first of all, the pressure is terrible, you know.
Exactly how does it work? You publish on a Sunday, you presumably
had to
deliver on a Wednesday?
Thursday. And And I was making it up as I go along. And one of the things that you realize, first of all, if you're going to do this, and I advise anybody out there thinking of doing it to change your mind immediately for your own sanity's sake, the first thing to remember is do not do a heavily plotted story. Because the more plot there is, the more you have to tie up. And usually when you tie up something at the end, you have to have seeded it, you know, further back in the book. And I, of course, forgot to do all that. I felt the first half of the book as a serial stood up reasonably well. But then it's easy. Anybody can write the first, you know, the first few chapters of a book. It's the, you know, thickening it, deepening it, finding an ending that actually satisfies and pulls together everything that's gone before. That's the hard part.
Did it inevitably pull a lightness of creation into the book? The idea that it was an entertainment, it feels a lot less ground in than your other two previous novels.
Yeah, I wanted to have fun. You know, I wanted to write a thriller that would, you know, that had something to say, but also would be fun, that had all the elements that a thriller would have. I mean, I hope an intelligent thriller. And I'd written Havoc in its third year. The book that had come before that was set in the 17th century. The language was very particular. I labored over, you know, every word in that book. I wanted to make it consistent with 7th, or at least of a piece with 17th century language. And I was also dealing with, you know, religious fundamentalism and persecution. So I wanted to do something, as I say, that still has something to say, but was in a lighter register.
Just staying with Havoc for a second, the solution you achieved to the problem of how do you reconcile a 17th century context with contemporary language was to conjure large parts of it out of the what sounds like the King James authorized vocabulary and syntax. That must make it phenomenally difficult for that book to travel.
That book has only been... I mean, but Zugzwang is in 15 or 20 languages. Havoc is in 3, I think. It had 2 other translations. It was a very difficult book to translate.
And presumably, however, one of the joys for you of the allegorical historical style is that not only are those ideas of religious intolerance, the ideas of social justice and misogyny, they're absolutely familiar to us now. Are you more depressed and more negative as a historian looking forward than you think some of your contemporaries are?
Well, you see, I think, you know, it's because I started as a historian, but I think that nothing that's happening today hasn't happened in the past. Sorry, that's a very ugly way of putting it. I should say that everything that's happened today has happened in the past. And I think the lessons are there. So in some ways, I mean, I think the usefulness of history and even perhaps some historical fiction is that you can see that this experience we are going through has happened before and we've got through it. The depressing part of it is that so few of our leaders pay any attention or see even have any remote interest in what has happened in the past. They say, for example, at the beginning, just before the invasion of Iraq, to me as a youth was I grew up in Ireland in the late 60s and 70s. I was kind of a teenager in the late 60s, 70s. And, as you probably know, there was a great deal of political strife. In 69, there had been agitation over one man, one vote, and discrimination against Catholics, and so on. And I, even as a 12, 13-year-old, I went on demonstrations. We were very influenced by the American Civil Rights Movement. We sang that song, "We Shall Overcome." I remember I refused to take part in a family dinner on Christmas Day because there was a march going to Long Kesh internment camp, which was the prison, the big prison camp that the British had interned without trial Irish Republicans. This was December 71, and my mother was furious and so on. But I marched off, it was about whatever it is, 10 miles or so to the camp with other demonstrators. And when I saw the camp, it's like a prisoner of war camp from the Second World War. Low Nissen huts and guard towers and dogs and so on. And we were there, we weren't allowed to get right up to the camp, but we stayed at night and it got dark. And I remember the thing that really hit me, and I can feel the hairs in my arms raise now, it was the lights, these with other Republican, by then there was about 2,000 Republican prisoners. I was no sooner in the prison than there was a riot in the prison and the entire prison was burned down. I always said to people, if you're going to burn a prison in a country like Ireland, which is cold in the winter, don't do it in October, because we lived out in the open, really like as kind of people on the street. We had, beards, we used blankets as ponchos, we were unwashed, there were no toilets, and we lived like that for a couple of months. Now, in that atmosphere, to be frank, in that atmosphere, we did not discuss literature. We did not discuss poetry. What we discussed was the situation in Vietnam or in Cuba. That was what was important to us. Another thing, too, that's very important about that period for me was that in that prison you have, say, 2,000, 2,500 men, and every single one of them has a tragedy, that they're in prison for a long time, their families. The man who slept next to me during that period, there'd simultaneously been a fire in his house at home, and his three children had burned to death. And he got the news, a guard came in and said, "Your three kids are dead." So everybody had a tragedy. And you were not encouraged to talk about your own tragedy. Nobody was, in fact, we were very careful about not using the personal pronoun I. And in fact, Gerry Adams, the leader of Sinn Féin, if you listen to him in conversation, he very rarely uses the personal pronoun. He will say things like, "those of us in leadership positions," or some such. We were not encouraged. Nobody said, "don't use this word," but it was just part of the atmosphere. Well, of course, writing really is about serious writing really is about an exploration of yourself. You have to open up. You have to. It's you. This wasn't encouraged. Literature, yeah, there were books around and so on, but they weren't. Novels and books of poetry, they were around and they were read, but they weren't important. At 18, in those conditions, a friend of mine, an older man, well, I say older, he was 26, and there were one or two, the prison camp was a young person's experience. I remember there was somebody of about 40 who was in there, and we all felt so sorry for him the British could be so cruel as to put in prison somebody of that age. Somebody so old didn't deserve to be in there.
What had he done?
he was an IRA man. He'd probably blown up something or something like that. But my older friend, Sean Hanna, said, do not read. Don't waste your time on books like this. Don't. He said, it's bourgeois. It's nonsense. It's a form of masturbation. And I believed him. And for 10 years, I was... I quite like solitude, but you know there can be too much of it. When you're a writer of a novel, you are the director of your own novel. As a screenwriter, you have to accept that your vision for the film, your script, will be taken over by somebody else, and you can collaborate with that person. And I've got good relationships with directors that I've worked with. And but I'm always aware that it's their project now. They take it off, and I want them to make my script better. I like the process, particularly, you know, because in recent years, because I've done quite a lot, I can now more or less choose who I work with, and you avoid working with people who are fools and psychopaths and
so on. You can spot them that early.
No, well, that's the problem. That's the problem, because obviously in those first meetings, everybody puts it's like going out on a date. You know, everybody puts their best foot forward and is as charming as they can possibly be. And then the true psychopath kind of comes through at a later point.
But presumably there's also a case, and I assume that this might pertain to the American blockbuster movie you've just written, where you are chosen for a project rather than a subject matter and a character and a story coming to you yourself.
Yeah,
how did Public Enemies come about?
Public Enemies, the film with Michael Mann, the director Michael Mann, who's done, I mean, I think Michael's a genius. I think he's done some fantastic movies like Heat, Last of the Mohicans, The Insider, I think is a terrific film about the tobacco industry in America. But one day I just got a call, and this is, I think I told you yesterday, that one of the great things about being a writer is you never know what the next phone call will be. You know, you might be shortlisted for a prize, or somebody's bought your book in Spain or Russia or whatever. But this was a call.
I love it that all your calls are good news calls.
No, well, I'm trying to be positive, but you know, some of them are not good news. But this was, I had a call, and it was somebody saying, I have Michael Mann for you. And Michael came on, and he told me about this project. He asked me to come over. I went over. We met. And I went away and wrote the script. And that was it.
But he gave you the subject. He said, this is the general tone. These are the actors that I want you to write for. These are...
Well, originally it was Leonardo DiCaprio was attached to the project, but that was all I knew. And being attached to a project is a very, you know, as you probably know, it's a very loose term in film.
It means has once met the producer at a party.
So, yeah, and said, yeah, you might be interested in that. But then I got, you know, 2 years later, I got another call to say that Johnny Depp was now doing the part, and they were starting filming in 3 months. So that's the way it happens. With that film, with Hollywood, I mean, I'm not a big player in Hollywood by any means. I get offered some stuff, some I do, some I think I won't do. And I was very much, you know, a writer for hire for Michael. I mean, he liked my work, and that's why he contacted me. But it's a Michael Mann movie. When that movie comes out, it'll be a Johnny... It won't be a Ronan Bennett movie, you know. But... In the stuff that I do, the independent movies that I do in stuff for television, that's much more of a collaborative process, and I have I'm much more involved in that.
Is there anything in terms of construction of story that you bring from the film world to novel fiction?
Possibly. I mean, I think film is such an economical medium. When I sit down to write a screenplay, I know I've got 110 pages. You know, if you hand in 150 pages, it looks amateurish. So you're looking to kind of get everything in about 110 pages, thereabouts. And that imposes a discipline. It imposes a kind of economy. It means that you've got to move fast, that every word has to earn its place. With a novel, novel is as long as it has to be. But I still keep an eye open for redundancies, or at least I try to, for redundancies, for repetitions, for, you know, keeping a scene or a sequence going too long.
Writing Six Fang, which has a certain number of chapters, and is actually, as in that sense, as defined at the start as your screenplays would be. When you came to rewrite it or publish it as a book, how much revision were you wanting and willing and able to do?
Well, I actually wanted to do more revision than the publishers wanted me to do, really. They were quite keen to get into print as soon as possible. But I met my editor, and after a talk, you know, we both agreed that actually it could be better. Because what appears, you know, the thing about newspapers, newspaper today, cat litter tomorrow. So, but a book, you know, a book is judged. And... I wanted to make it as good as it could be. I didn't want it to go out there half-baked. Too embarrassing, just pride. So I reworked a lot of it, and particularly the ending, other parts too, substantially. The first half, I think, is recognizable from the Observer serialization. After that, there are big changes.
Can I ask one more question before opening this to the floor? Because I know that there are questions about fiction and film and activism that people will want to know. How much now of your time do you spend thinking about fiction? Having had this experience of writing something on a weekly basis to deadline, now that you have the freedom, the financial freedom from Hollywood, to write whatever you want and take however long you want to take it, How much of that is a liberty, and how much of it is a profound burden?
No, there's no burdens. I don't believe that writers should complain about anything, to be honest. We are very privileged people. It's not a burden. And to be honest, the financial security that's come from doing movies, I don't think has any... I've never written a book with the intention to please... I love it. Believe me, I love it if people love my book. When people come up to me and say, I really liked your book, I'm really thrilled. I also like it if people buy the book. That's another big thrill, too. But I never write a book thinking, I wonder if this will sell. I wrote a book set in Latin America, my second novel, Overthrown by Strangers. And it's my least read and least... it's my least read book because I traveled from Mexico to Chile. I took a year to do it. And I wasn't in places like this. I wasn't in the hotel that we were in. I stayed in dollar-a-night places. And I was struck... It was my first time in Latin America, and I was struck by how hard it was. You know, all the parallels with Ireland and the repression in Ireland. This was just repression writ large. I've bribed my way into prisons. I bribed my way into Canto Grande in Lima, where the Senderista prisoners were, and I spent a whole day in their block. I traveled to, I didn't try to get off the kind of gringo trail and get into out of the way places. And I was just struck by this, and I was very influenced by, what's it called? Las Venas Abiertas de Latino America, that book. Struck by that book and just the levels of poverty. And there was a statistic that has stayed with me, which is that an Andean peasant has a shorter life expectancy today than he did before the conquest. I think that says something. But I poured it all into the book, and as a result, nobody read it. You know, it was just too hard. It was too hard for people to take. So I suppose I have that awareness, but I would never write a book with the idea of pleasing somebody. When I give lectures to new writers or people who are thinking about writing, at universities and so on, I always say you've got to write what you feel passionate about. You've got to, don't second guess. Make it come from you. So I do try to follow that, regardless of where it goes.
Do you get the same satisfaction from completing a screenplay
as from a novel?
Yeah.
No, nothing like it. And a screenplay is never complete.
Delivering, I should have said.
Well, delivering. No. I mean, a screenplay. You can write a screenplay in 12 weeks. I mean, maybe there's some of you out there who can write a book in 12 weeks, but I can't. A screenplay should only... you break it down, 110 pages divided by... my maths isn't very good. But it's not very many pages a day. And you're expected to deliver. So, it's... And if you don't, what are you doing with your time if you can't? I mean, I sometimes meet people and they've been working on the same screenplay for 2 years. And we talk about it. And I always go away thinking, what are you doing with your time? What can you be doing?
Ronan, thank you. Can I, at this point, ask if anybody in the audience would like to ask anything? Because I suspect that just as there are allegories that find resonance in Northern Ireland, there are stories of Ronan's that will find resonance all around the world and also in Colombia. I actually can't see anything. Oh, now I can. We have mics. Would anybody like to... Oh, yeah, there are two down the front here. Yeah, guy just there.
Oh, do I need...
Me?
Oh.
Oh, good. As somebody who has been there in the struggle in Ireland, we are facing the struggle here in Colombia with the FARC. As somebody who has seen the end of the tunnel, as somebody who has been fighting and so active in the struggle in Ireland, do you have something to tell us about the guerrillas here?